One of my favorite recent clinical studies and publications in oncology is a New England Journal paper from Mass General, whose principal investigator is Dr. Jennifer Temel. What this fascinating trial truly tells us about modern oncology can be debated, but there can be no question that it strikes at the heart of clinical practice. I met with Dr. Temel for her take on this.
This study really started from my clinical observation that the traditional model of an oncologist taking care of a patient with an advanced solid tumor is just not sufficient. That an oncologist, you know, does a great job of managing the cancer, recommending treatments, managing side effects, but there's so much more that patients and their families go through when facing a cancer diagnosis that it just wasn't feeling like the oncologist was providing all of the comprehensive care that a patient and family needed. And so we thought that as palliative care was a growing specialty when we started this research 10 years ago, that it was possible that palliative care could play a complementary role co-managing patients along with oncology. And so that's how we started this research. Actually, when we began this research platform, palliative care was still a hospital-based consult service, mostly seeing patients at the end of life. So it really did require some restructuring of clinical orientation to even bring palliative care to the ambulatory care setting and figure out how to provide co-management of these patients. In the study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, we basically enrolled 150 patients with newly diagnosed metastatic non-small cell lung cancer and randomized them to standard oncology care or standard oncology care integrated with palliative care. All the patients on this study received standard oncology care. So their oncologist made all of their treatment decisions about chemotherapy, radiation, whether or not they should go on a clinical trial. So really, cancer-directed therapy wasn't impacted by the study, but patients who were assigned to the early palliative care arm received concurrent care and met with the palliative care physician or nurse practitioner at least monthly throughout the course of their illness.
Maybe you can go through sort of what the results were, but also a little bit more about the intervention itself and what actually happened.
So patients who were assigned to the intervention, as I mentioned, met with a palliative care physician or nurse practitioner at least monthly throughout the course of their illness. And one interesting aspect of this study is that we actually didn't prescribe the palliative care intervention. That palliative care clinicians were permitted to evaluate the patient and focus on the issues or challenges that were most salient for the patient and family at that time. You know, there are a number of oncology and palliative care organizations that have developed guidelines for palliative care, and we followed them in general. But what we found is that, you know, often when the palliative care clinician walked into the room, the patient sort of led the discussion. So, for example, if the palliative care clinician had seen the patient last time and pain was a big issue and they spent the entire visit talking about pain management, the palliative care clinician could have expected the follow-up visit to all be about pain. But when the clinician walked in the room, the patient would often say, "Am I going to die of this?" Or, you know, similarly, "My daughter is really struggling in school. I don't know how to help her." So we didn't really feel like the palliative care could be a structured intervention, although that certainly is a challenge for thinking about how to move this work forward. Nonetheless, patients who were assigned to the palliative care arm had improvement in their quality of life at 12 weeks. They also had lower rates of depression. And in addition, they also were more likely to have an accurate assessment of their illness and prognosis.
And I see, you know, a lot of work that you've done subsequent to that that explores a lot of those issues. But could you talk about essentially what you saw in this randomized study in terms of the impact on survival in addition to quality of life that you just mentioned?
So the reason we even thought about looking at survival, although certainly with such a small sample size, the study wasn't powered for survival, was because I think there was a lot of concern by oncologists that having palliative care involved with patients could potentially decrease their survival, that palliative care might, quote unquote, convince people to not do chemotherapy and that their survival would be shorter. However, we had no indication in our study that survival was shorter. In fact, there was some indication that survival could be longer, although again, it was a very small sample size. But I think what's encouraging is a number of prior studies looking at palliative and supportive care interventions have actually found similar findings. There was a study looking at a similar type of palliative care intervention that found a several-month prolongation of survival, and a study that was retrospective but looked at similar cohorts of patients who received hospice and didn't receive hospice, and those who received hospice care did live longer than those who didn't. So there's a clear suggestion in the literature that better palliative and supportive care can impact survival.
And how many patients were in the study, and what actually was the difference in survival?
So there were 150 patients in the study, and the median survival difference was a bit over 2 months.
So, you know, those are the kinds of numbers we see a lot of times with therapeutic agents that end up getting approved. Can you maybe provide more of a flavor of what you think was actually occurring and what these patients received that they weren't receiving from their oncologist?
My guess is that the biggest role that palliative care plays in these patients is helping patients and families cope with living with a life-threatening illness. To me, that's the most challenging part of a cancer diagnosis, and that is pervasive whether they have an epidermal growth factor receptor mutation and are going to receive erlotinib and live for years, or whether they have squamous cell carcinoma or a KRAS mutation and their prognosis may be months. That once someone has incurable or terminal cancer diagnosis, it's incredibly challenging for them. Vicki Jackson, who's the chief of palliative care at Mass General, talks about sort of the swinging pendulum of prognostic awareness. And although as oncologists and palliative care clinicians, we feel it's important for patients to have illness and prognostic understanding, on the flip side, you know, you can't wake up every morning, start the day saying, hey, I'm going to die. And so finding the right balance between being accepting of what the future will hold for you and making appropriate plans, but still getting through life and facing each day and trying to live life to the fullest, I think is incredibly challenging. And that's true whether, again, it's a good prognosis or poor prognosis lung cancer, even for women with breast cancer. You know, women with metastatic breast cancer are somewhat ignored when it comes to thinking about palliative and end-of-life care because their prognosis is so good. And that is absolutely true. But again, they're still waking up every day knowing that they have a life-threatening illness. And I think that that is incredibly challenging for all of us to deal with.
What do we know about how people react to this situation and what happens if there's a benefit that's happening in this, you know, interaction between the palliative care specialist and the patient and family? What's it about? Is it about, you know, alleviating depression? Is it getting people to exercise? What do you think is going on?
I think there's probably a combination of things. In general, I do feel like medical oncologists do a pretty good job with symptom management. Now, that's not to say that palliative care, you know, doesn't have more experience with drugs like methadone or, for example, if someone needs to have a celiac nerve block. So some of those specialty pain managements, they certainly have more experience with. But I do feel like overall, oncologists do a pretty good job with symptom management. But I feel like where we are less well-trained, less experienced, is really on helping patients and families cope with living with a life-threatening illness and even engaging in conversations with them about what types of information that they need to know, what's important to them, and how to make decisions about their care. You know, your average oncologist doesn't sit with a patient and clearly explain that the reality is that for most people, especially for metastatic lung cancer, the chemotherapy, the impact on life expectancy is just a couple of months. But that is an important piece of information for many people, and to think about how to balance how they want to live their life and how to take into account the quality of life with or without chemotherapy. And I do think the palliative care clinicians are more comfortable and experienced engaging in these types of conversations.
Again, I'm thinking about Tom Lynch because I know a lot of his patients, he was one of the docs who was taking care of the patients that was going into your study. And we talked about it right after it was published. And I asked him the same kind of question. And he brought up the term, I think it was existential angst somehow, which is sort of like kind of what you're getting at here. But I couldn't quite get beyond that. I mean, when you look at a patient and you compare a patient who's had somebody, whether it's a palliative care person or not, who is talking to them about these issues, seeing it as a life problem for them to deal with actively, what do you see? Do you see less depression? Do you see people feeling better? I mean, qualitatively in your own experience, what do you think happens?
Well, certainly in the palliative care study, we found lower rates of depression for patients receiving early palliative care, and that did not seem attributable to higher rates of antidepressant medications. So it's certainly possible that giving patients the space and the time to have these conversations with someone who felt comfortable having it could have led to less depression. You know, there is also a little bit of data that our group has found that patients who have better prognostic understanding and are more accepting that their illness is terminal, that they actually may have more anxiety. So I think these are incredibly complex issues, but I feel like no one is diagnosed with cancer, and the thought that they could die doesn't cross their mind. Whether it's a basal cell carcinoma or a lung cancer, anyone who hears the word cancer in their mind is, could I die from this? And I think not feeling like you have the space to have a conversation about that or express your fears is very challenging for patients and their families. And I also do think that there is a major component of patients putting on a brave face for their oncologist. Because, you know, I'm like Tom Lynch. He trained me. I feel like I'm a really good communicator. I try really hard to have open communication with my patients. And I can spend 40 minutes in the room with them. I leave the room, the palliative care clinician walks in, and the patient feels comfortable talking about things that they absolutely didn't feel comfortable talking to me about. So I think the oncologist holding the chemo key really inhibits patients from speaking openly about some of their larger fears and worries about their diagnosis. One important thing to remember about palliative care is it's not going to be available or accessible to people everywhere. So I think even though the palliative care research should continue and expand, for many patients in the United States and in other areas, early palliative care is just not going to be an option. So I think it's important to continue to think about patient-directed and physician-directed interventions to focus on some of the issues that, for example, palliative care can focus on. So some of the other work that we've done is really encouraging oncologists to initiate conversations about end-of-life care preferences earlier in the course of disease and to make sure that these preferences are documented in an accessible fashion. You know, unfortunately, most conversations about end-of-life care preference happens when someone's in the hospital, which I think is the absolute worst place for that to happen. Because often when someone's in the hospital, it's not the physician or nurse practitioner who have been taking care of them for months and years initiating the conversation. When patients are in the hospital, they're obviously very sick, and it's an emotionally heightened state for patients and their families. And so I think focusing on trying to move conversations about end-of-life care preferences earlier in the course of illness into the ambulatory care setting needs to be a focus of care.
You know, I at times have gotten sort of pushback from oncologists in practice about directives for end-of-life care. You know, I know the patient, you know, we kind of talk around it, but I don't get them to sign a paper is something that I've heard people say. Any thoughts?
I actually generally engage in conversations with patients actually about their resuscitation preference. So in my mind, and I think this is somewhat controversial, but for patients who have a certainty of death, so we're not talking about you or I getting in a car accident and theoretically what our preferences would be, but for someone who has a life-threatening illness, who has a high chance of dying in the upcoming months or year, I don't think there's a role for vague advance directives or even necessarily a healthcare proxy. I think the appropriate way to handle end-of-life care discussions in someone with a certainty of soon death is to ask them about their actual resuscitation preferences. And generally, how I approach it with patients is I explain to them that in light of their metastatic disease and their current health state, that if they were to have a life-threatening event, the chance of them surviving it and getting back home and having a good quality of life would be incredibly small. So that I recommend to them that we don't do heroic measures in face of a life-threatening event. And then that usually transitions to a conversation about the appropriate timing for hospice care.
And how do you find patients and families responding to that?
You know, again, no one with cancer hasn't thought about the fact that they're going to die. So overall, I find that patients are often, not only are they ready to talk about their end-of-life care preferences, they're often wondering why you haven't brought it up earlier, that they've had conversations with their primary care doc about it, with their family about it, and they're like, why the heck haven't you asked me earlier? And I would say about half the time that I bring it up and I start saying words like heroic measures, resuscitation, even though often using more lay terms, people are like immediately, oh, I would never want that. My family all knows that. So that happens so frequently, and that's a reminder of the patients have known for months that they don't want heroic measures, that they want to be a do not resuscitate, do not intubate. But because I've never asked them, it was never documented. And in that, you know, I put the patient in harm's way because if they did have to call an ambulance or come to the emergency room with distress, they could have received care that was incongruous with their goals and wishes. So I think these are hard conversations. Certainly they're emotional conversations, but I think we need to be doing them more often and certainly trying to push them to the ambulatory care setting and out of the hospital.
Maybe, you know, another way for us to sort of get into, you know, what you've learned from your work would be to go through some of these cases that you brought in. Let's start out with your 52-year-old lady.
So this is a patient who has newly diagnosed metastatic disease. She's actually had metastatic disease for about a year now and has been receiving erlotinib for her metastatic EGFR-positive lung cancer. And again, you know, when we see these patients with newly diagnosed disease and their EGFR or their ALK comes back, you know, we say things like, you've won the cancer lottery and you're so lucky and this is such great news. And certainly from our perspective as oncologists, yeah, it's better than a KRAS lung cancer because the survival is a little bit longer. But these patients are still facing a life-threatening illness. And I'm personally finding that all of the excitement and cheerleading and sort of media we have about the EGFR-positive and ALK-positive lung cancer is making it difficult for them because I feel like the highs are much higher and the lows are much lower. And when these people actually progress, it's incredibly hard for them to accept that they had this golden ticket and now their cancer is growing and there aren't great treatments for them. So again, I would argue that these patients, even with their better prognosis cancer, there's a clear role for palliative and supportive care, helping them cope with their illness. Certainly these medications do have some toxicities and side effects that need to be managed, but I think we need to focus on supportive care as much for these patients with good prognosis mutation cancers as the average cancer patient.
Yeah, I saw your work and you had a paper specifically looking at the issue of depression and, you know, I guess tumor genotype. And I was fascinated. I immediately thought about HER2-positive breast cancer. And it's the same kind of thing. I mean, yes, those women live longer and all, but I think the real thing is there's so much excitement from a research perspective. We see new agents, you know, these EGFR, ALK, all this stuff, resistance, you know, we're all excited. But as you point out, when you look at the bottom line today, it's still not a great situation for these patients. What do you think was going on that these people had less depression? Do you think they were picking up? Or did I understand that right? They were less depressed?
That's exactly right. So patients, before either the patient or the physician knew about their EGFR mutation status, patients who turned out to be EGFR mutation positive had lower rates of depression. You know, I think for years and years, there's been some indications that there could be a biological basis for many of the symptoms faced by patients with cancer, but really that research is in its infancy. So we are doing a prospective study following up on those findings. The study is actually sponsored by the American Cancer Society, and to date, we've enrolled almost 100 patients, and we do baseline assessments of depression, again, before the mutation testing is back, to try to further investigate that preliminary finding.
Oh, I didn't pick up on this. So this is before they knew whether or not there was a mutation there?
Exactly. Because one could argue once they know the mutation, they'd be less depressed because, again, you know, their oncologist tells them they've won the golden ticket. But this was before anybody was aware of their EGFR mutation status. So maybe there's a biological difference between patients who have EGFR positive lung cancer and those who don't.
How about if just the fact there are more non-smokers and non-smokers maybe have different personalities?
That is true. And certainly smoking and some of the comorbid disease that goes along with that can increase rates of depression. So in the current study, we are looking at all of those factors.
So anyhow, I'm just kind of curious, you know, how you might approach, I mean, this situation, you know, there are a lot of people out there getting treated with EGFR TKIs with mutations in this situation. I'm kind of curious how you approach a patient like this, maybe that might be different than the way she might have been approached in a, you know, community-based setting. Now, she's right now on erlotinib?
She is.
And what kind of toxicity is she experiencing?
You know, overall, I do think that these drugs are fairly well tolerated, although for patients who are on them for months and months or years, and I have a handful of patients who have been on erlotinib for years, you know, I do find that the chronic skin and eye changes can be challenging for them. But certainly the toxicity, at least in the long term, is generally less than patients who are receiving cytotoxic chemotherapy. I do think we probably underestimate the fatigue impact of these drugs. And I do think that patients who are on, you know, erlotinib and similar medications do have some fatigue that's often troubling for patients.
So this lady now, is she experiencing any side effects from the tumor? Where does she have it? Where are the mets to?
She actually has CNS metastasis and leptomeningeal spread. So she actually does have some side effects from her leptomeningeal disease.
So she's had also radiation therapy?
Exactly.
Were you able to pick up any cognitive or emotional impact of that?
No, the only symptoms that this patient has from her leptomeningeal disease is actually some cranial nerve symptoms. So she has a little bit of numbness in her face.
And she has disease outside the CNS?
Yes, which has been under control with erlotinib. And unfortunately, as we all know, once people have CNS progression on these targeted therapies, it's a difficult situation, certainly once they've had radiation therapy. So I think we try to keep them on erlotinib as long as possible, try to do localized therapy, for example, with stereotactic radiation if their brain mets are progressing. But for leptomeningeal disease, I've never recommended, for example, intrathecal chemotherapy for patients with lung cancer, and I wouldn't recommend that for this patient moving forward. You know, there is some data that pemetrexed may have some CNS penetration, so that would be a next step potentially for this patient.
So has she received palliative care?
This patient does happen to be on the palliative care study and is receiving early palliative care. And again, I do think that this patient is an example of someone who has an EGFR mutation and is absolutely benefiting from the involvement of the palliative care team. So again, it hasn't been about symptom management. This patient has no pain and no shortness of breath, nothing that needs intervention. But it's really with coping with having a life-threatening disease, planning for her husband and her children as she becomes more ill with her cancer, trying to balance things like work and being home with her family. And I think the palliative care provider has been incredibly helpful for her and her family in balancing all of these things and making decisions about the future.
So the palliative care, there's one specific person who tends to see her, or is she seen by a team? Is it a physician?
So that's a good point. So we have a very active and busy palliative care ambulatory service at Mass General, and it is staffed by physicians and nurse practitioners. Because our palliative care clinic is in an academic medical center, very similar to oncology, the palliative care clinicians are there 1 or 2 days a week. So what happens is that patients who are on the early palliative care study, for example, my patients tend to always come on the same day of the week. So if this patient comes on a Monday, she sees the palliative care provider that's there on Mondays. They do also have nurse practitioners that they use very similarly to how we do in oncology, that they try to make sure that each patient knows the palliative care nurse practitioner and physician so that there's always someone available that they know.
So what have you learned about exactly what's happening when this woman sees the palliative care team? And do they interact with you? Do they send the emails? Does the patient tell you? How do you learn about what's going on and what are they doing?
So we are incredibly fortunate that our palliative care clinic is embedded right in our cancer center. So actually the palliative care office is located right between the lung cancer clinic and the GI cancer clinic, and they actually see patients in the same space as we do. So often the oncologist sees the patient first and then the palliative care sees the patient. Otherwise, we've often done visits together where the oncologist and palliative care sees the patient together, and I think those visits are incredibly gratifying. So because of our co-localization, we haven't had to have, you know, team meetings or forced email. The conversation between the palliative care clinician and the oncologist happens very organically. I do get a lot of calls and emails from people who are trying to do integrated palliative care research. And one of the challenges that most institutions have is that their palliative care clinic is located down the street or on another building or sometimes even just on another floor. And I do feel like once you have to have a patient move to another setting, it is much harder to integrate these services. So I feel like ideally the palliative care clinician should come to the patient. That just clearly requires space and staffing that most people just don't have.
So could you cite, you know, 1 or 2 examples of specific things that have happened with this lady that you think somehow were beneficial because she was getting palliative care?
I think for her in particular, travel is very, very important to her. And the palliative care clinician has really helped her balance coming in for visits and treatment. I didn't clarify all the information, but this patient happens to be on a clinical trial and trying to balance when to move clinical trial visits and how to balance the travel. I think the other aspect that's been challenging for her is really the work-life balance. Prior to her diagnosis, she had a very high-power job. And like many patients who are well but have a serious illness, they often feel better if they continue to work. But a lot of people have that distress, like, I want to work, it gives me something to get up in the morning for, it makes me feel good about myself. But if I only have a year to live, do I really want to be spending 50 hours a week at my job and not with my friends and family? And I think those are very difficult decisions that the palliative care clinicians have helped her navigate very well.
So if somebody's listening to this and says, well, yeah, you know, you're putting more resources out to the patient and in arenas that really are going to make a difference, it's not too hard to figure out that it's going to be helpful. How do I get it paid for? So let's say I want to see it get integrated into my practice. Is that a feasible possibility from a, you know, business perspective?
I think currently it is challenging. You know, in Massachusetts, we've been very fortunate to get good reimbursement rates for palliative care, and basically they bill based on the symptoms that they're focusing on. But I think it's going to be imperative moving forward that healthcare policy adapts to some of these changes. I know several years ago when there was concern about death panels, it was sort of an end to positive discussions about palliative care policy. But I think we're moving back towards trying to get some of these issues on the agenda. You know, American Cancer Society has a very large presence and lobbying efforts into trying to get some healthcare policy on palliative care to make it greater reimbursed, ensure that physicians have appropriate training and education on palliative and supportive care. And I think all of these measures are incredibly important.
So before we go into your next patient, I was curious, you were talking about this issue of the side effects of EGFR TKIs, and I see that you were a part of the SELECT study, which is evaluated, and they just reported last year, erlotinib in the adjuvant setting, one-arm study, everybody got erlotinib, I think it was for about 2 years. I always like to ask every time I run into somebody who put patients on that study or any study like that, you know, what's it like to try to use erlotinib in the adjuvant setting? Is it fundamentally different? If it turns out that it really works, how hard is it going to be?
I did enroll a number of patients on that study, and I would say it was fairly challenging. Again, there's no data on this, but my personal experience or sense is that, you know, if you have a chance of cure, your willingness or acceptability of toxicity is a little bit less. Meaning even when it comes to adjuvant chemotherapy, I feel like patients are much more willing to quit adjuvant chemotherapy than they are, for example, when they have metastatic disease. So my overall sense is that patients in the adjuvant setting didn't tolerate erlotinib as well as they do in the metastatic setting. In general, too, these patients were on it for a longer period of time because the median time to progression for patients with metastatic disease is about 10 months, and these patients were supposed to be on erlotinib for 2 years. And I do find that the chronic side effects, the skin and nail changes, eyelash changes, eye changes, are really challenging from a quality of life perspective. You know, the acute rash and diarrhea, you can get most people through that with medications, dose holding, dose adjustments. But those chronic changes are really challenging. I have a patient with metastatic disease who's been on erlotinib for about 3 years. And her eye changes are incredibly, incredibly challenging. You know, very dry eyes, a lot of irritation, constant tearing. And it's really made it challenging for her to work and do the things that she enjoys. So I do think some of these side effects can be very difficult for patients.
Yeah, I block on the actual name of it, but the thing where they get the long eyelashes that have to be cut, is that something you've seen?
Yes, it's very, very challenging. And, you know, I do think you're bringing up a very good point that making sure that these patients have their eyelashes checked by an optometrist or ophthalmologist earlier, because sometimes these patients have chronic eye irritation for months and months and no one figures out what it is, because some of these eyelashes that are growing inwards and irritating the cornea are so small that you're not seeing them on exam. So I have patients who, again, they see their optometrist or ophthalmologist and they use a magnifying glass and make sure that they're snipping the ones that are irritating.
So how about your 49-year-old lady?
So this was a patient who had metastatic disease. She actually had early stage disease that popped up over about a decade. So it had a couple resections, a couple localized radiation, And then she actually had clear metastatic disease and had progressed through chemotherapy with carboplatin and pemetrexed, and then maintenance pemetrexed. And she was actually referred to me for a clinical trial. Things went very poorly for her on a clinical trial. I think one important point about this is that many of the clinical trials that we're seeing in oncology are with multiple oral agents. And I do think there's sort of a public perception that oral agents must be easier than intravenous chemotherapy. And I think we're learning that these multi-targeted oral agents are actually incredibly difficult. And she did quite poorly on the clinical trial and declined with worsening shortness of breath and progressive disease, and sort of came in about 3 weeks into the trial and was doing very, very poorly. One sort of clinical thing that I personally find challenging is when I haven't been involved with patients from the start. So because this patient was referred for a clinical trial, I had only been taking care of her for a short amount of time. So I didn't have that longitudinal relationship. I didn't know so much what her goals and values were. I hadn't had a discussion about end-of-life care. So she came in somewhat of an urgent or emergent situation that she was declining very rapidly and was the single parent of a 10-year-old son. So it forced us to have somewhat of an urgent end-of-life care conversation.
Can you talk a little bit more about what you talked about?
I think overall, obviously, when we're talking about parents and end-of-life care, it's incredibly, incredibly challenging, and it was very, very difficult for her. Luckily, in her case, although I had failed to initiate conversations about guardianship and end-of-life care planning in light of her son, she was smart enough to have made those decisions and had plans in place for him. And I think an important point of that is, you know, we hear people say all the time, you know, they didn't discuss end-of-life care or they're not discussing supportive care because it's a young person with a young child, or that, you know, they're giving this very aggressive treatment because it's a young patient and we want to do everything we can. And really, my experience has been the most important thing to a parent is their child. And so avoiding conversations about end-of-life care or giving overly aggressive therapy that's going to make people feel miserable and not able to enjoy their last months or last year with their children isn't always the best thing for patients. And I think it's very important to make sure that people have plans in place. I was just speaking with some friends who were explaining to me that when they fly without their children, they never fly on the same airplane. Because if, God forbid, the plane went down, they don't ever want to have their last moments of life be worrying about what's happening to their children. And for me, that was really very likened to what I do, that the reality is that for parents, they're most concerned about what happens to their children and making sure that they leave a legacy for them. So communicating with patients about their prognosis, giving them a sense of what their life expectancy is so they can make appropriate plans for their children, do things like leave a legacy, you know, if they're not going to be there for their child's graduation, write them a note, if they're not going to be there for their wedding. I think by not engaging in these types of conversations with parents, we're really robbing them of these important events for their children.
So, you know, just listening to this and imagining you in this situation, talking to this woman, you know, certainly this is unfortunately a daily part of oncology practice. And just kind of curious what we know about how oncologists cope with this burnout, problems that they might experience resulting from it, ways to avoid that, and what you do yourself.
You know, the reality is that these are incredibly sad conversations, no matter who you are and no matter how you approach them. You know, when you're sitting with a young person, you know, sometimes when you're sitting with an old person, these are very hard things to do. My approach might be a little different from others, but I'm sort of comfortable letting the emotional aspect come out. I don't cry hysterically with patients, but when you're having sad conversations, you get sad. And I feel comfortable, especially, you know, generally as oncologists, one of the best things about being an oncologist is that you develop these incredibly close longitudinal relationships with patients. So most of the time, you know, we know our patients, we know our families, we know their husbands, their brothers, their children. And I think it's okay to feel some of that emotion, feel sad when you're having these conversations, and grieve after your patient dies. Our thoracic oncology group at Mass General, we do a yearly memorial service or remembrance service where we invite our families of all of the patients who passed away within the previous year to come, and we do a little service. We read out all of the names of the patients who passed away within the last year, and we show a slideshow if families send in pictures of their deceased family member. I don't know how much it helps the families, but it certainly helps the doctors, nurses, social workers, secretaries, because I think it's really important for us to have that time and space every year to think about all the patients that we've had who've passed away and all the families that we miss. I think that's a challenge that we all feel is you're grieving the loss of the patient, but for many of these patients, you've also become incredibly close to their families, but that relationship also ends after the patient dies.
So how about your 53-year-old man?
Yes. So this was a man who has recurrent squamous cell after receiving chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery for a localized disease. He actually had a complete response to chemotherapy and radiation. So at the time of his lobectomy, had no disease left, all necrosis. But unfortunately, just a few months later on restaging scans, had an adrenal metastasis. And now I've seen him. I've let him know that unfortunately he now has metastatic disease, and we talked about the role of chemotherapy to help him live longer with disease, prevent spread, and maybe impact symptoms. And it was really important for him to have a sense of the magnitude of benefit of chemotherapy. Although that can be very challenging information to put in lay people terms, I did the best I could, and I talked about the magnitude of benefit of chemotherapy in general being months. And when he heard that information, he actually became very disinterested in chemotherapy and really thought that there was no reason to pursue chemotherapy if it was only going to impact his life expectancy for a few months. And I think that those are challenging situations, but I do always reinforce to my patients that they need to make the decisions that are best for them. I know at some institutions, if someone's not getting chemotherapy, they're not encouraged to come back to the cancer center. And I always make sure that my patients understand whether they're receiving chemotherapy or not, that I'm their oncologist. I will see them every month and take care of them. And I think it's important to provide patients with the information that they need to know and help them make decisions that are best for them.
So what's going on right now with this man?
At this point, he has decided to defer chemotherapy. And again, I think even though I feel like he made that decision with me and we had a good conversation about it, that his family was present and supported that decision. You know, deep down, I am an oncologist and I give chemo for a living. And, you know, I respect his decision. I know it's the right decision for him, but I do think it's difficult for us as oncologists when we have these treatments. And again, Tom Lynch always says this, we don't give chemotherapy so that everybody can live a couple of months longer. We give chemotherapy for that tail on the end of the curve because we know that some percentage of patients, 5 to 10%, are going to have a huge impact on their life expectancy from chemotherapy. I have 5 or 6 patients right now who have literally been on maintenance pemetrexed for 4 and 5 years. Now, the reality is it may not be the maintenance pemetrexed that's keeping them alive 4 to 5 years, but there probably are a subset of patients where chemotherapy really does have a substantial and significant impact on their life expectancy. And I think we all feel like, what if it's this guy? What if it's my patient, this 53-year-old man, who was going to be the lucky one and have, you know, 2, 3, 5-year survival with his metastatic disease if he would have accepted chemotherapy? And I think that's why we sort of all buy in to the next treatment, trying the next thing, trying the next clinical trial, because we all want our patients to be the winners of that golden ticket. And unfortunately, right now, it's still very few patients.
Do you have more information in terms of what this man's experience was with chemotherapy and where these feelings came from about it and what he knew about chemo?
He did great with his preoperative chemotherapy and radiation. No problems, soared right through, really did very well. But I think for some people, again, we don't usually see it in a 50-year-old. Sometimes we see it in 70 or 80-year-olds, but it's just not worth it to them. You know, no matter what we do, no matter how much antiemetics we give, no matter how much supportive care we give, sometimes we use methylphenidate for energy, you know, people feel crummy on chemotherapy. There's no way around it. You know, even pemetrexed, which is quote unquote our easy chemo, you know, patients feel crummy. And when you actually give them a chemo holiday, they look back and can't believe how crummy they actually felt because they get so used to it. And so, you know, it's never crazy for someone to defer chemotherapy when they have incurable disease. So I do think he's making the decision that's best for him. I think it's important to let these patients know that decisions are never final. So I did give him the space to say, you know, if you change your mind, come back. And I think that's always really important. You know, even when I refer patients to hospice, I always schedule them to come back and see me in a week or two. You know, I let them know that maybe why they're doing so poorly now is because of the chemotherapy. And if in a couple of weeks off chemotherapy, they're feeling better and want to re-engage in a conversation, that they should come back.